Hello, welcome to the Dev Discussions podcast. I'm Sean McCool, and today I'm here with Thomas van der Berg.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for coming, Thomas. I found you because you were working on this game called Kingdom, and I really enjoyed the game. First of all, I loved the graphic style, and that's what grabbed me. And then I got it, and it was just exactly the kind of game I want, something that doesn't hold your hand too much, something that where you can explore and experience something, an atmosphere that is just separate from something you've done before. And then when I found out you were in Amsterdam and I was just 25-minute train ride south, I was thinking maybe this is an opportunity to get this guy in a conversation about building this game.
Well, that's very cool.
So can you tell me and the people listening maybe a little bit about yourself first?
So I built this game together with a few people of like a different composition at times. I worked together with another developer, with pixel artists, and I kind of started working on it 4 years ago, just after I graduated. I studied AI, actually, artificial intelligence. And yeah, I felt during writing my thesis that I wasn't doing a lot of creative work. It was a lot of writing, and my graphs and charts looked really nice, but the rest of it is like very... can be dry at times. So then I was kind of making this game as a creative outlet and turned into something which is very, very cool that I could pursue this as like a professional.
Now, did some of your education creep its way into this project?
I wish. I mean, game AI is typically not very fundamental. It's very practical. It's supposed to do something. There's been like some, you know, goal-oriented action planning where you search for a way, a series of actions to achieve a certain goal, but still it's not compared to like the academic AI that we do. I would like it to be though. I think there's cool stuff to be done there.
Now, when you're building this game, what kind of tech stack is it built on? So you're using Unity, right?
It's Unity, yeah.
Is it completely Unity?
Yeah, Unity and then some, you know, shell scripts and some junk around it, but
for building or something?
Exactly, for build. Yeah, for
building. Do you do that for asset building?
Not even. I try, because I'm just one guy, I try to keep the pipeline as short as possible. Like everything has to basically be, you could just export it from the visual editor, like, you know, Photoshop or Pixel Edit, and then just straight into the game. Because if there's going to be steps in between, it's going to make it hard to revise graphics later on. I mean, you could automate those steps, but then you would have to automate them good.
Like, yeah.
Yeah.
Do you end up coding mostly in C# or Unity script or?
Yeah, C#. Yeah.
Now, is that something that you've known how to do? Or is that something you've picked up over the past 4 years?
Yeah, I picked it up. I did Java before, so I was used to like the strict type languages. Before that, during studying, I used Python almost exclusively. And then I was like a super fan of Python. I was like, oh my God, why would you ever use anything that's like typed? And then I started using C# for game development. I was like, why would you use an untyped language? God, I can't imagine like the compiler not telling you immediately that, oh, wait, this is the wrong type. Or even your editor just going like, no, that doesn't work that way. I don't know if I would go back to Python now, what that would feel like either.
Yeah, I think that at least in Unity, it also comes with performance degradation. Those Unity script and Boo.
Right. But those are, I mean, even Unity script is still a typed language. I mean, I think so, because it compiles to, what did they use, like Mono, and then it compiles to like the intermediate language. It's still, at some point, it's like strictly typed, just that you don't maybe, you know how in C# you can see var, V-A-R, and it's not necessarily untyped, but it's like it just infers the type.
I think
that, yeah, that Unity script does that too.
Yeah, that's cool. I haven't used it much. I've just favored C# because like you, I came and I had Java under my belt already, and C# and Java are... Well, C# is Microsoft's answer to Java.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, you know, I always, everybody likes to hate on Microsoft, but I think C# is a very straightforward language. You know, it's like, okay, what does a programming language look like? Well, it has curly braces. It has, you know, like everything is just in there. It's like very vanilla in a way. It's like, okay, yeah, you get it if you see it.
And I think that actually Microsoft has some of the best development tools, in my opinion. I'm a Linux enthusiast. I have my own special UI and I'm doing all my own custom scripting for everything. But at the end of the day, I have a Linux machine and a Windows machine. And on Windows, I'm developing with Visual Studio using ReSharper.
Yeah.
And
I'm jealous of that. I'm on a Mac and sometimes I see visuals. I'm like, okay, that's kind of nice.
Are you using MonoDevelop or
no, VS Code? Yeah.
Yeah. VS Getting Code. There. Does it have refactoring tools?
Some. Like, you can rename a variable and it will actually rename the variable, not just like syntactically. Like. Mm-hmm.
I find that those refactoring tools I've grown more and more fond of over time,
yeah,
to the point where being able to make these structural changes to my system, exactly, and knowing nothing is going to break.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I know like VI and these other text editors, they have tools for refactoring, but they use a lot of like regex type stuff.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And it's messy and sometimes just brings in bugs that you didn't expect.
Yeah. I mean, it makes you a lot less picky when you're writing your code. You're like, I don't care about the variable name because I can just change it later. So you just type something and then later, if you don't like it anymore, you just change it in one go. And that just makes you not have to think ahead as much.
I know that Unity uses the component entity system. So you have these entities and you're attaching components,
yeah,
to make all these things. One way of developing in Unity is to put it all into the scene and then have these scenes differentiated from one another by what is composed in that scene. Another way is to have these objects in the scenes that load and bootstrap the game into like one scene for the entire,
yeah,
game. So, but is there a way that you prefer to approach it? Like in Kingdom, are you constructing the maps or components in the scene view, or is it being built maybe with other objects?
I was actually reading about like entity component system in Unity a while back, and people have some serious objections to it. But I think that's not the same thing that you're asking. And in Kingdom, it's kind of, the thing is like rigged in the scene, like it's kind of composed in the scene. Like half the game is already there, the layers are there, the camera setup is there, so it's not done through code. It's just like completely kind of dragged and dropped into the scene. But then since it's a random map, the map objects are kind of generated in there. So the first thing the game does is actually delete everything in the game layer and then like puts new trees and bushes and everything in there until it's like filled out again.
Interesting. So are you using like prefabs to render those into the scene?
Yeah, and I tried, you know, I figured if you're working in a tool, even if you don't maybe agree with how the tool works, it's best to kind of go with the kind of workflow that they have. Otherwise, you're just going to end up like struggling. So I just kind of figured, okay, Unity has this concept called prefabs. You can't nest them. Okay, then I won't nest them. Sometimes you would want to, but instead of building a whole system that allows you to nest prefabs, I just figured, let's just roll with it and do what Unity wants you to do. And you get pretty far.
Yeah, so prefabs are when you take multiple components, multiple entities, and stick them together with pre-configured attributes, I guess. And
yeah,
then you save them so that you can just load them back later.
Exactly.
Now, nesting prefabs allows you to make some parent and some children. And while Unity has some capacity for that, it doesn't really let you see into that structure and work into that structure.
Yeah.
And some people have released actual libraries to do that.
Yeah.
But then you end up with all this additional complexity.
Yeah.
And you're just praying that one of these Jenga,
yeah,
pieces doesn't just pull out and make the whole tower collapse.
Yeah, you put the finger on the spot there. It's like with Unity, sometimes you get the feeling of like praying, like that nothing goes wrong under the hood, because it can be like catastrophic, you know, because you don't have like super good insight into like what's really being serialized into the scene. And like you get better at it, you learn to read it, but then like that's why I didn't mess with those prefabs, because I figured I don't want to get bitten by that. So
When I'm working in Unity, I have this board game, and what I do is I build the prefabs in the scene. So I design everything and,
yeah,
put it together. And then I store it away, and then I actually have code that generates everything and puts it all together.
Yeah.
So then at the end of the day, like I start off when I'm prototyping with everything in the scene.
Yeah.
And then when I get much closer to something that's really functional, there's nothing in the scene except for one entity with a script that just bootstraps it all.
I think that's the workflow they envision too. Like you can just build stuff, and then if you figure like, oh, I'm going to need this set of game objects later, then you just export it out to a prefab, and you can still... Yeah.
Yeah. And do you have like an architecture to your application? Because I have approached a lot of Unity projects where literally I'm just using entities and components, and that's basically it. I just write a little script, I attach it to the,
yeah,
entity, and that's everything. But then, you know, you have some projects where you actually have an entire object graph of an architecture of event handlers, event listeners, dispatchers,
mm-hmm,
all kinds of stuff going on. What are you using on this project?
right now it's all very straightforward, naive. So just like you said, just game objects with components on them. And then there's a whole object in the scene that's called the managers, and it has like a whole bunch of game objects, like the audio manager, the ambient manager, the game, I don't know. But definitely next time, like, lessons have been learned here, I'm going to do it much more strictly, like you said, with like a more in code defining the event handlers, and less depending on Unity's, like, especially something like the update order. At first you think like, oh, I have a game object. I write an update function and the update function will get called every frame. That's nice. And you kind of fill it out. And then at some point you realize that you have no control over the order in which Unity updates these objects. So, and you kind of want that. And then you figure, well, I should have just like centrally administered my objects, because it's okay to have a list of like all the archers in game and then run over that list and call archer.update on each archer. But that's kind of something you figure out like in the last half.
Yeah, that's what Unity is doing. But since all of those updates, you have no idea of what order they're being called.
Yeah.
They end up having to be in themselves a whole coherent process.
Yeah.
So that's like in like database kind of lingo. These components themselves are transactional boundaries, where if something is going to happen in this component, it can't rely on something from something else.
Yeah.
And if it's going to change some kind of state, it can't interfere. It can't damage the process of something else. So
that,
it's really kind of complicated.
As well, like if your update functions are always transactional, that might be, you know, nice for the layout of the rest of your project. You're not like tying everything up and making them order dependent. But yeah, it's very loosely coupled. Like, people are like, oh, let's see if there's even an audio manager in this game. Find object of type audio manager, and then you have to handle what if it's there, what if it's not there. Like, yeah,
it's a little scary to me using kind of that. It's like a rapid application development workflow.
Yeah,
you know, it's amazing because it allows you to start working on something. And when I'm playing or making a game, rather, I want to be touching something with a gamepad as fast as possible.
True.
That way I can start to get a feel for even what it is I'm doing, because no matter what my idea is, it always becomes something different once I start touching it.
Yeah, that's true.
And so I kind of worship that idea of being able to get something on the screen fast. And this is one reason that I like Unity, because I don't have to know anything. I don't have to know anything about what I'm building, really, in order to get it slammed in there, get it running. Have you ever used other tools like GameMaker Studio or?
Nope. I used the Pygame once, but it's like just a bare bones engine thing.
Yeah, it's funny, like GameMaker Studio is even easier than Unity.
Yeah, I can't even imagine that. That's what people tell me. I'm like, how could it be even easier?
Until you want to do something kind of complicated, then it's far more difficult.
Yeah, I can imagine.
So, you know, the guys at Flambeer, I'm sure that they have their entire way of working figured out, and they know the tool inside and out. But I find that I can get a shooter, like a side-scrolling shooter, working in about an hour and a half with sounds, with enemies, with waves. And that just blows my mind how you can get something done so quickly. In Unity, it would take me like 6 hours to do that. But part of the problem is I would actually approach that using much more architecture and software design.
Yeah.
So that's going to slow me down. But then I end up with something that's so much more robust. I'm really interested in, for example, how you take your system, your software Kingdom, built in Unity, and then what's your path to deploying that? So I think you might be working on console releases right now.
Yeah.
So right now it's available on PC.
That's it.
Mac?
PC, Mac, Linux. Desktop platforms,
okay.
Yeah.
And is the Linux release kind of newish?
No, I think it's always been in there.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's also an amazing thing about Unity, is that it builds the Linux from a Mac. And that build, we've tested it a few times, and we've been releasing just, you know, we don't have a huge farm of devices where we can test, but we just kind of trust that it will work, and it usually does. It's, you know, it has the same bugs that the PC version has.
Yeah.
And that's great.
It's really amazing.
Yeah.
If nothing else, I appreciate Unity for helping to invigorate the Linux gaming world.
Yeah. Because everybody feels like, well, it's just another checkbox. Let's just do it. And Unity might be wonky sometimes, but it's so consistent between platforms. Like, it has the same bugs on every platform. I'm constantly amazed by how easy it is to press the iOS button, press the Android button, and boom.
So what's it like actually deploying something to Steam? Like, when I deploy to servers or server farms or something along those lines.
I have a lot of friends in web development, and they always look at me like, you don't have unit tests. You, like, deploy to production on a Friday afternoon. Like, I'm like, yep, that's games. We just, you know, send it out there. But Steam is good. They have, like a huge backend thing with a command line tool that kind of pushes things to their backend, which is, you know, it looks like a PHP website from the 90s, but it works. It works really well. So my workflow is I have a set of build scripts. I put everything in script because there's a bunch of checkboxes and you're always going to forget to turn off the debug panel before you send it to, you know, so I have a bunch of build scripts that just like make sure that all the checkboxes are in the right places. If you've been debugging, you've probably messed a lot of stuff up and these scripts check. Haven't you messed up the scene? Is this still enabled, etc.? They make a build for all the platforms, and then I have another, like a shell script that just calls the Steam script and sends it over. That's it. So it's basically two steps, and I can have a new build on Steam.
That's awesome. So you don't have unit tests, and I can understand why, because when you have this component entity system, what do you just... I mean, you're so much relying on the mono behavior, this built-in functionality of Unity.
Yeah.
And you're going to have to almost reproduce that behavior in order to... even test these components.
Yeah.
So I can understand how that makes it difficult. Do you find that you don't feel like you're on top of the bug sometimes? Like you're just genuinely scared that something is broken?
Only sometimes, because really most of the times the bugs are in, you know, in my code and not in the actual engine. And then I feel like, okay, I could know this, but yeah. So only sometimes is it that I feel something really weird is going on here. Yeah.
And how do you catch bugs? Does somebody tells you?
Yeah, we do beta tests. And I mean, like, by far the majority of bugs have been related to saving and loading the game, serializing the game state into a file and then loading it back up and expecting the game to be in the exact same state. And
can I ask how you go about saving your games?
Yeah, it's not very strict because we didn't do it from the beginning. So we kind of just, every entity in the game, so you have like Archer, Tree, like every, these things are also prefabs. There's just like, they're all like monolithic entities. Like there's no composition of those. So everything is like, you know, one thing, one ground tile, one Archer, one player, one guy, one arrow. The game just like iterates over all of those. They all have a component that's called a persistent component. And that component kind of checks up with the other entities, see which one of them implements an interface that says, hey, I got some extra data to serialize. For example, archers and all of your, like your troops, as well as the enemies have a component that's called damageable, which implements this interface. And that will, this damageable component will say like, hey, I only got 5 hit points left. So please write that to your data as well. And then later when you're loading it up, it does the exact same thing in the opposite order. So it goes through the list of objects and then restores all these variables that they requested to be stored. The thing is, you forget stuff. Like, you know, damageable will loyally like serialize your current hit point value, but it might not serialize the fact that this entity was at the moment invulnerable because it had like picked up the crown and couldn't be killed anymore. So then you forget that and you save and load, and suddenly the loaded state is not the same. In this system, there's no way to enforce that you're really going over every data and deciding whether or not it's essential. So you forget data and then the game restores in a different state, which varies from okay, it's a little bit different to it's just completely bugged now.
I can see how that might be difficult to discover in the first place, because like I might save my game and then a day later come back and entirely on the other side of the map, some minor bit of state was different, and how am I supposed to know?
Yeah. So the next time I build a game, kind of Unity encourages you initially to just put all your variables in one big pile. You know, you have this component that's called Archer, and you put in there like number of arrows, like
a player controller or a character controller.
Like a character controller. You just put all your variables in that thing. Mm-hmm. And then you kind of mix, usually, like some people have conventions which variables they make public and which they make private, but then you kind of mix stuff like the initial state of the Archer. Like a new Archer will have 5 arrows on his back. How many arrows he currently has? And all sorts of like internal variables, like is he in an animation or that sort of stuff. You just kind of mix them all up in there. And then later when you're saving your game state, you have to go through and see which ones are essential and which ones aren't. Next time, I'm just going to like separate that out from the start.
Like state pattern? Where you have just an object
inside it that says like, this is the state that's essential. The rest of it you can just throw away as long as you restore this state. But Unity doesn't really encourage you to do that at all. Also, it just encourages you to put something like in the initial state of the Archer, just put it right in there instead of like putting this in a config file.
Like an initialized variable at the top, like player life equals 5.
Yeah, exactly. That stuff is like, okay, now it's 5. And you ideally, you would want that stuff like out somewhere else so that you can go over and balance the game by tweaking those variables. But it's one big soup, which works great, but sometimes at the end, you kind of...
I think it's interesting because, for example, on the web, we build these things that are constantly running, have to stay maintainable for 5 years, you know, that kind of thing. Where I always think about game development as you're just racing to get done, and once you launch, well, it doesn't have to change anymore.
That's true. That's definitely true.
So it's like you have this great opportunity to not have to really carefully design things for long-term maintenance.
Yeah, except for those like early access games.
Yeah, a lot of games are different now.
Yeah.
It used to be that once a game shipped, it was done. But now you're having these hot reloads on day one or hot patches on day one. And like, for example, Kingdom has been out for quite some time, but you're still building it. You're still adding to it.
And only now we're at a point where we don't have to wipe people's save game every time we update the game.
That's awesome. The good thing about that for your game, though, is that you just restart so frequently anyway.
Yeah.
That it's not the worst case.
Not exactly. Yeah. But people tend to be surprised and they're like, what? Why? Yeah.
What kind of technical challenges have you faced? I mean, I know you said that you came with a little bit of Java. You learned C Sharp over the past 4 years. You've probably had to learn Unity over that time as well.
Yeah.
And then all the stuff like deploying to different platforms and stuff. But there's a lot of things in Kingdom that are pretty novel, I think, like the way that displacement maps are used for a lot of the graphic effects, especially the water, which is really, I think a lot of people really appreciate that water. When you're implementing these things, what brings it? Is it some understanding of the mathematics that drives it? Or is it you just have this idea and you go figure out how to implement it and try it out?
For the water, it's a very... It's a mathematical approach. I mean, it's like the idea that when you're looking at a surface of water that is wavy and not straight, then of course the reflection of the light ray is going to be in a somewhat different place. So if you're okay with displacement maps on there, this is also a technique that I found long ago for some flash game. Otherwise, it's usually just kind of based on the effect that I want to get, like, for example, the fire or something. I wanted to have a certain pixely look, but still be kind of lively. And then you kind of go about different ways of trying that. It's a lot of trial and error. And technically, I think I invested a lot of time in building custom editors for things. And that has helped too. Because just to make the workflow as easy as possible. And then later, it's okay to be making content for a few days because you've made the tools to make making content easy for yourself.
Now, those tools, are they built inside Unity 3D or are they built inside your actual game?
Some are built into the game. Most of them are built into Unity. But the debug panel inside the game has grown a lot since the start of it. Like, now we're using it to record trailers as well.
Trailers?
Yeah.
So you actually are recording...
We're recording outside of it, but we're using that tool to like pause the game, put in extra entities, slowing it down, panning the camera for somewhere to somewhere else.
Nice.
Yeah. You end up building those things anyway.
Do you have anything specifically that you think might be relevant or interesting that you would like to talk about that I wouldn't be able to think up?
Oh, yeah, good question. I don't know. I think what we were talking about before, we can kind of delve into a little bit deeper. The things about like how Unity uses this entity component system, and the thing that I said, I saw people saying that it's not a real entity component system because it doesn't separate out the data. Like data and procedures are all like mixed up in these components.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen some people build those. I saw a very cool talk of like this thing called Entitas, whatever, like they built an entity component system for Unity. But then in the end, you're kind of building your whole game outside of Unity, so you might also lose some of the advantages. So for me, it's always trying to walk the line of like, well, the engine wants me to do it like this, but I could, you know, you could build your own thing. I know the people from Weirdbeard, I looked at their Unity and they did the thing where it's like completely empty scene, one object that's like everything is encoded there and they load everything in through code. And then I guess they use Unity for platform compilation and that kind of stuff. But,
and also, it has a really nice asset pipeline, I think.
Yeah.
It makes it really easy. Unity makes it really easy to bring in assets.
Oh, you mean like importing stuff and yeah, true.
For example, like you can just save a PSD and then use the PSD directly within Unity.
Really?
Yeah, it'll load PSDs and you can actually pull out from those into sprite maps and everything like
that. Oh, yeah. I mean, okay, if I would ever do a 3D game, I see where that would come in incredibly handy.
Yeah, have you tried anything like a multi-layer architecture? Because one thing that I found when working with Unity is I use the component entity system as more of like a presentation layer. So in my architecture, you have everything that's happening on the screen, in your ear, and then input from the player. And then those interact on this one layer. And then below that, we have more of like a domain layer where that's the actual logic and behavior for the stuff in the system. So in the example of Kingdom, I might have an archer. And that archer is a basically a presentation level archer. It's the it's the part that has all the animation scripts on it and stuff like this. And that's the stuff that you see. And then inside, I would have an object reference to another archer that exists in a different layer of the application that knows nothing about user input, that knows nothing about visuals, display, anything, and only has the actual domain logic, like the rules about what an archer wants to do. You know, and then so it then receives messages from the user interface layer, which includes user input, lack of user input.
So, how does that look like in Unity, like very specifically?
Yeah, so what I'll do is I'll have a script, a C-sharp script that's a mono behavior on that actual entity.
And the entity has maybe a renderer on it, I suppose?
Yeah, the normal stuff. Sprite renderer, sprite animation stuff, audio, whatever, basically whatever you would normally
have. And that one single mono behavior.
Yeah, that one single mono behavior. In this case, I can see how you put more on for different things. I don't know, but in this case of the archer, that mono behavior would then have an instance to a new object that's called an archer.
And that's not a mono behavior?
No, it's just a C-sharp script that has only the domain logic, and it doesn't know anything about any of the rest.
Right.
And in that way, I can do things like have a one place to go to find all of the behavioral attributes and all of the behavior for that. And I found that has been really nice, because I can unit test that. I can actually test the behavior for that object
separately. And it works without even the...
Yeah, I just test it with Visual Studio. So I just say, hey, Visual Studio, run my test. Boom, 180 tests.
And does the whole game engine run... Let's say, where's the hook? For example, when you update this, let's stick with Archer, does that come from Unity's update hook somewhere down the line?
Yeah, see, what does update like really mean necessarily in this context? So the Archer's running, for example. And so maybe time passes, so you call an update, for example. That's why you call update, right? Because time passes.
Yeah.
So, and it's going to have probably, it may or may not have a time delta.
Yeah.
I don't know. I would probably try to keep as much of that out as possible and then translate that to just math. Like, so I pass in some kind of value and it gives me back some kind of number. It's fully functional. It doesn't hold state on exactly, you know, where this and that. Because I don't want to hold state if at all possible to avoid it. But what you can do is from that presentation layer, know what's happening. Like that archer might actually be then accessible directly by some other domain entity. So it knows about the archers. And then maybe if some of your archers get killed, then these archers have to reposition themselves around the kingdom.
Yeah, yeah.
And then they're given the order or to reposition. But in reality, they're probably not in charge of the repositioning. It's probably a separate object that exists solely to encapsulate that behavior.
Just that behavior?
Just that behavior. Yeah.
And then basically you have that object, which then gets a collection of all the archers. And then it just says, this is what you want to do.
Yeah.
And then you can have all these different service objects which have one specific behavior in mind.
Yeah.
And then they interact on these domain objects like Archer, Builder, etc. And all of these individual objects can then be completely tested. You can test all of the different behaviors that they have. And then the bugs you have are solely in the presentation layer and not in your intentions for how these are supposed to operate. And so then you can even take it a step further. Instead of just doing unit tests, you can do tests by specification. And then if you do that, you say, okay, an archer is defined as these specifications. And then you can actually, you have this tremendous amount of documentation provided that you can give to other developers that can help and clarify what's happening here. Because I find when I'm coding in kind of this rapid application development style, which again, I don't want to make it sound like it's not a good idea, because I think it's really great. I think it's really important.
I think when you say that, that's kind of how Kingdom is built. It's kind of like just everything is in there, like presentation and behaviors and everything.
Just but then I just, I find that I don't know what to expect out of the system until I interact with the system.
Yeah.
And when in the web, I know that my system works before I ever run anything.
Yeah.
Because I actually, I just know because the tests are there.
Yeah.
So to me, it's like bridging these two kind of worlds where it's, you can't just unit test everything in a game. Why? Because these things are constantly changing. What am I supposed to do? The specification for this archer is to behave like this. Yeah. And then 10 minutes later, it changes completely.
Yeah.
But it only changes for 15 minutes and then it changes to something completely different. You can't really do TDD and stuff like that on this kind of behavior. But there are systems where it does apply, right?
Yeah.
Like maybe more architectural things like event dispatching, stuff like this.
Yeah, I saw once where a studio had a build script that would fail if a screenshot changed. So they had a screenshot and it had to be pixel by pixel the same every time. Like they would build, run the game, wait 5 seconds, and then that's very...
Yeah, very deterministic
system
then.
Yeah, but you know, it's kind of... You expect it to be the same every time, and then maybe like if the pixel changes, like why did it change, and then you can go figure it out.
And you can run on different systems.
Yeah.
And then if the screenshots are different, then you're identifying new interesting...
Yeah, they're for sure going to be different on different systems, of course, because of like rounding or... Few, like,
yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, I think that's a good way to build the game. I mean, I'm wondering how developing like that feels in a game where things change very fast. Like in Kingdom, it constantly happened where he said like, oh, let's have a unit like this, and he does something like that. Like it stayed kind of prototypey, like way down the line. And then now it's easy because you can just go into a random unit's update function and say like, okay, let's have a look at if he's near to this kind of entity, and you don't have to, you know, write any extra services or what you call them for that. But it also makes it hard to debug sometimes. Like there's a lot of stuff going on, and it's all like going on in a lot of different places.
So how do you handle input? Does every individual... So in this case, you're really only controlling one thing directly.
Yeah.
Your character.
Yeah.
So inside that update, are you then pulling the controller?
We actually went from doing that to pulling the controller in a central location in the game. And then there's an interface called iControllable. And so then in the game, a character or a unit can say, I want to be controlled right now. So that's what the player character does. The first thing it does is like, yo, I'm the player character. I'm the guy on the horse. I need to be the one receiving control. So he registers himself to the game and he will receive control. Because we wanted for trailers also to be able to control other units. So they can also, if they implement iControllable, then they just, you know, can say like, hey, I want to be the entity to receive control right now.
Yeah, and also you have a user interface.
And then user interface is kind of skimmed off the top even before that. Like before control is sent to any kind of unit, it's checked for like a UI input. Like, did you press the start button? Okay, are we in the menu? Then maybe you need to do some stuff. It's kind of spliced together.
Have you worked on a project that was different than Kingdom before in Unity? Like anything half seriously or...
No, before this I was actually working in open frameworks, making things for a huge screen with a motion sensor that they put on a square where people can play games in front of it. So it had to parse like the motion sensor input and then just put cool graphics and stuff on the screen. I think now I would have built that in Unity too, probably, just for the game engine bits of it. It's so much easier.
Yeah. Have you tried out other frameworks? You said you worked with Pygame.
Yeah.
A little bit, because you were into Python.
Yeah.
Right now my kid's learning Python, so yeah. I'm a little bit nervous about showing her game development right yet, because I think it's neat to get into like logic and formalizing logic and kind of figuring that out, because there's a joy to it.
Yeah.
That you find, I think. But then you suddenly realize that games are this horribly challenging mix of disciplines, and it all comes together. It's really difficult. I actually tell people all the time that web development is way more complicated than other people perceive. Like, it's a lot more complicated than usually desktop application development, because you have to deal with this a tremendous amount of technologies.
But then that's why in web development there have been a lot of like methodologies for doing it. And in game development, we have them, but kind of, sort of. And Unity is kind of half of such a methodology, and it doesn't completely enforce it. And I feel like if there is already a method that is appropriate, that will work, then I'm going to learn it, you know? Like, I'll give it to me, and because we kind of need it, like some very strict way of...
I think part of the problem is with game development, when you have a game, it's actually just like a system. It's a system with a shape, like it's geometric kind of in nature. Yeah. And the shape of your system then is reflected in the code, right? So the way something's implemented is a reflection of what the system is. So if you're making a first-person shooter, great, there's probably a lot of best practices for doing that because it's a known domain. We get a lot of this stuff already.
Yeah.
But if you're kind of implementing something weird, like, I don't know, Nobi Nobi Boy or you know, something else, then you have entirely different shapes to implement. And I don't know that there's really best practices that can apply to a lot of this stuff. You're figuring out as you go.
But the same goes for websites, no? Like, the thing that they try to implement is also can be wildly different. And then still there is a kind of best practices, like,
There's best practices in certain spots. Like, that's what I think Unity is doing. It's doing kind of like the web framework thing where, okay, we know how to get a request from the browser into the system. Mm-hmm. Then we route that request with the relevant data to executable code.
Yeah.
And then from there, you have to figure out what you're doing, you know, kind of. And of course, in some situations, even those obvious bits are suddenly challenges because you're facing 40 million Pokemon Go logins all at once, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's, I think there's a lot of best practices in game development, but I don't ever hear of much architecture and software design in the world of game programming. I don't hear it very much.
No. Well, like you said, I guess for FPSs, they are so... They've been...
I mean, even there, you have so much... Like detail, like what they do with like Call of Duty and stuff like this, like all of these little things that you never identify that are programmed in about how the camera works, about how these other things. I don't know that you can use off the shelf ideas for a lot of that, but at the same time, they're iterating on something they've already had.
Yeah.
So they've already designed.
Yeah.
So
it's very specific. Like, I guess the architecture that they have is the Call of Duty architecture. It's like, it's that game. And their methodology is the methodology of building a Call of Duty game. It's like, you know, it's so specifically tuned towards that, what that game is. I guess it's what you just said. Like, every game, because they need to be so optimized, you kind of end up like chiseling off every bit that made it generic. And then it's like, no, it's just this game, if you want it to run like super optimally.
Yeah, I think the Witcher is the same engine from the very first Witcher game all the way to now.
Yeah.
And they've just been changing it over and over again over time. And I guess that's one of the reasons why it comes across so different from a lot of the other games as far as its presentation. And
yeah, that's weird. It's weird how much the engine can impact the feel of the game. Like, people will often say like, oh, this is a Unity game. Like, and they can like feel it. Like,
you can tell a lot of time, especially if they're using something like capsule colliders in a 2D
game.
That's just the worst. It's like my personal pet peeve. You can't use capsule colliders
in a 2D game or at all.
No, I mean, like, you have a side-scrolling platformer, like Mario or something, but you can't use a capsule collider for that because you get near the edge of something and just kind of fall off.
Yeah, exactly.
And I've seen, like, all these games on Steam. So here's a question for you. Like, on Steam, you see all these just games that are incredibly amateurish.
Yeah.
How hard do you think it would be for me to go and make something in 2 weeks and throw it on Steam and make money?
I think you could. I think you could either go through Greenlight or just contact Steam if you have something. I mean, right now, a lot of games get on Steam, and I think the cost for Steam is, of course, very low. As long as they've got curation down, because people have been complaining about that, you know, like, oh, there's all this shit on Steam, like, how do we find the good stuff? But now that they're kind of working towards with a discovery queue and having curators, it's not... Steam has no... There's no downside for them to just get more games on there. So, yeah.
And has Steam been a big part of your strategy, for example?
Yeah, definitely.
Central, maybe?
Yeah, surely. I mean, it is very cool that I could go up to my laptop right now and create an executable that just displays a pile of poop on a screen, and I could hit update, and then, like, I don't know how many people would just have that executable on their system.
Finally.
Yeah, I mean, but, like, Steam is so, like, it lets you do everything. Like, it just, they're like, as long as you're, as at the point when you're okayed, you can just push out updates to everybody. And that's like, it's very different, of course, from how consoles do that. But it's a very PC way of doing things, you know, like, if it doesn't work, they will complain, but PC users are okay with that. They're okay with going into an ini file and fixing some stuff. And
it seems like it's a really good time to just, if you want to get into game development and you want to do, put
exactly.
something out, now it's like a good time to get
exactly.
started.
And you can, it doesn't have, if you're a one-man show, it doesn't have to be super polished or anything, because there's both platforms out there and audiences that will allow you to just put something on there. So
I can only imagine that the reach of something on Steam is just insane. It's just crazy. Because
yeah,
I personally go in there and I do the whole discovery queue, and I'm like, I don't know, 4,000 games in on my discovery queue or something like
wow.
that. Like, because, you know, I get bored and I just click, and I'll add to my wish list.
I mean, yeah, and then people complain about visibility. Like, why doesn't anybody buy my game? Well, that's kind of like the flip side of that. Like, there's so many games and so easy to get out there that it's not automatically, you won't automatically get noticed if your game is on Steam anymore.
Now, have you thought about adding, I don't know, something like multiplayer or online to Kingdom? I'm not saying that's necessarily a good idea. I'm just curious about how
we've thought about, like, maybe doing, I think multiplayer, like, there are better strategy games out there. I mean, a lot of people are like, oh, it would be fun to play against other people. Well, then you would really start seeing the flaws of, like, the strategic part of this game. Like, I wouldn't recommend people play this against their friends, because it's just not fair.
It's not the competitive game.
And it's just completely, like, we kind of balanced it by roughly, like, tweaking some variables here and there until it's fun. And because it's like an infinite game, of course you're going to end up losing at some point, but it's not fair, you know? Like, so if you would play it against a friend, like, there would be all these flaws. Well, unless you would make it a perfectly symmetrical scenario, and then it would, of course, by definition be fair, but maybe not very fun. But co-op is something that we talked about, like building your kingdom together with someone else. The real big problem here is that this world of Kingdom, it really doesn't exist outside of the viewport. Like, if you move the viewport, the clouds, the water, everything is just there where you're looking. The rest of the world is just like paused, or bridging that is difficult from the current situation.
And that's so that you have the performance.
Yeah, exactly. Also, I mean, if we would have set things up a little bit more fundamentally, then maybe you could have easily added another viewport and just say, like, okay, well, it doesn't matter which viewport is looking at it, but you'll see it if either one is looking at it.
Just abstraction.
An abstraction, but you don't do that, because you just start, like, working at it right away, I think.
So how many times did you find yourself, okay, like, I need to rewrite this whole subsystem to make it work?
Oh, a lot. Yeah, I do that a lot, because at least, even if it's not completely abstracted, I do want it to be consistent. Like, so, you know, an entity, like all the archers and the workers, and they're like a shared kind of, like, a character component, and, you know, so those systems I did end up rewriting a lot. Also things like the system that kind of blends in the weather presets, because it's a very important central part of the game that makes it go from night to day, and like different kinds of that system too, because it needs to be fast and you need to be able to preview it live as you're working with it, stuff like that.
Is it weird that as a game designer and developer, you never actually get to play your game the way you're wanting other people to? You just never actually get to see it proper?
Because you know exactly what's going on?
Yeah,
because
you're so deep into every bit of it.
Yeah, but I do, surprisingly, like, I don't play it a lot, because I'm always very focused at a specific scenario. Like, oh, when the troll jumps into a farmer, he did, like, you know, and I set up that scenario in Unity, in the editor. That's a nice thing of working with Unity as well. You can set up a scenario, and then you press play and see what happens, and then it doesn't work the way you want to, and then you tweak the code, and then you press play again. Like, that's a nice thing of having this visual editor instead of... But so I do that, and then I just end up testing those little scenarios, and then usually at the end of a crunch, like, when I'm doing, like, full testing, and I sit back and I tell myself, okay, I'm just going to play the game, write down what I see, and not jump into code right away, just play for an hour. And then I feel like, wow, this is a cool game. I end up playing for, like, hours, like, oh, this is actually still pretty nice, even after all that time of developing.
How good are you at Kingdom?
Not so good, to be honest. Gordon, for example, one of the publishers, is way better than me. I just make mistakes that, but then I also make mistakes that I immediately realize, well, if a player makes this mistake, it's really unfair to him. So then I tend to fix those. Whereas other people who are better than me, they've just kind of learned to live with those caveats, you know, like, oh, if you build a wall, you have to let the grass grow past the wall first so that you have grass on the other side of the wall too. And I just build a wall immediately and then you block off the grass. But then I feel like this is unfair. So then I start looking for a way to prevent that through the game mechanics. I don't accept those scenarios that I find unfair to me, but that's also why I suck.
The game doesn't tell you how to do really anything. It doesn't say you can feed your horse. It doesn't say this. It doesn't say that. It doesn't tell you anything. It seems like a lot of what you're trying to do is give people something just to explore and make observations. Is it strange? Like, do you get feedback about this where I have no idea what to do? Like, I go and I buy these tools and, oh, I bought way too many hammers. I was just trying to do good. And now I have a bunch of builders and my entire game is blown now.
Yeah. But I think a lot of games are like that, to be honest. Like, when you play Civilization 5 or whatever for the first time, then of course there's a lot of text and there's a lot of explanation, but you basically make the same mistake. Like, you get too many tanks or you get too many whatever. So that's still something you have to learn, except in those games they do it with a lot of UI and a lot of different buttons, where in this game those learning aspects of what works and what doesn't are still in there, and then we just try to reduce the UI.
I have this dream of building this game where, and you just, grass grows and it grows on its own, and then maybe you have, like, in Kingdom's example, rabbits. So now rabbits go and they reproduce, and then you have, like, a wolf introduced into the system and it goes. Like, did that have anything to do with...
Yeah, that's basically what you describe is kind of precisely how Kingdom got started. It was like, okay, let's have a little world where there's dudes hunting rabbits, and that's how they make money. And then other people come in and take the money. There was supposed to be some kind of tax collector guys who would then redistribute the money. And I just wanted to see, like, what if you have this little simulation? What does it do? Like, does it diverge? Do you get one guy who's very rich and the other guy who isn't? And then at some point it kind of just turned into more of a game because there were enemies and then you had to defend. But it started out exactly like that. And I think that's exciting. But I think there's a kind of discrepancy. Like, why I find it cool to build is because I like building that simulation. And then people who like playing it, they're also in a limited way, they can mess with the simulation. Not like I did while building it. Like, I had everything at my disposal. So what I think would be interesting is to kind of find a game where the joy for the players is kind of the same as for the person who built it. Like, they can also mess with the simulation in the same kind of ways. You're just giving them kind of a grid to do that on. I mean, Minecraft in a way gets close to that. Like, the joy of building stuff in Minecraft is very close probably to the people who like actually built Minecraft itself. But I'm glad that Kingdom also is enjoyable just from a player's perspective, like, just, you know, playing inside the simulation, and you still have a lot to play with. Like, you can still mess with it in a lot of ways. People try to break it in different ways, and that's exactly what, you know, I would like to see more of. Just, yeah.
So what if, for someone who's listening, like, maybe they're a web developer, they have some amount of real development time below their belts, they can probably pick up C# if they don't know it already without too much trouble. If they were going to pick up Unity, do you have any ideas about advice or tips about how to perceive getting started that might help somebody get to a playable state quicker?
Well, I mean, in Unity, you can literally input 10 lines of code and you can have a box that jumps when you press a button. And I mean, that's kind of where a game should start. And if these people are developers, then probably something about development excites them. And that's also what happened in Kingdom. I just liked coding the water, just see what you can do with a bunch of shader code, and that can be a game. And it doesn't have to have a concept on paper, and you don't have to know what it's going to do beforehand. Just, yeah, get something that responds to a person and then put in your, like, your technical enthusiasm, like, try to build something weird.
I think one thing that's special about game development is that, okay, you code a bunch of stuff, fine, then you hit play and now you're interacting with something that's alive and magical, and
yeah,
it's like alive.
Yeah.
And it's something completely different. It's not like, you know, when you're doing stuff on the web, you have these forms and you have these connections and stuff like that. And once you leave your tool for a while and come back and use it, you're like, wow, I'm really impressed. This is something that actually works. But when you hit play, you get that, like, every time.
Constantly. Yeah, it's true.
Yeah, it's special. There's a lot of different ways to approach these problems too, like the problems of collision detection, for example. So when I'm writing a platformer in Unity, do I use the 2D physics thing? Well, I actually don't. I write my own ray casting physics solution because then I get a lot of control over my character.
Yeah.
But it's amazing what you can get done just out of the box.
Totally. You can build so many games out of, and so many different games too. I think some engines are more focused towards building a specific type of game, and they make that very easy. And Unity is reasonably neutral in that sense. Like, you can build a lot of different things with the same amount of ease, and some things are getting a little bit harder.
Now, how much of the music and graphics and stuff do you do?
I did the original graphics for when it first released on Steam, and then I got another pixel artist to help me out with some additional animations, because I'm not very fast at them. And this guy, Marta, he's just like, you know, oh, can we have running animations for all the characters? He's like, sure. And he just, all the characters get running animations in a week. And then the music, we contracted someone.
I think the music is great, really. Is really especially good. Like in the morning when the night's over and you get this little
yeah.
soft
sound. Yeah,
it's different on different days for whatever reason, I don't know. But you get this little welcoming, like, sigh of relief, the night's over.
It's very simple system, because some games have, like, you know, this layered music system where they play, like, you know, and combat music introduces a drum track into the same music, and they have, and we kind of didn't have time to do something like that, so we settled for something much more simple, which is that Amos, who did our music, just composed the tracks without loops, just full length tracks with a beginning and an end. And then I told him, okay, when do you want this track to play, at what time of day? And then I gave him a tool that says, there's a moment in this music, like, you just describe, like, this you know, what do you call, like, a turn in the tone of music. So pick that, like, let's say 40 seconds into the track, and that should be at 5:30 a.m. so he can, like, kind of anchor the music to a certain point. And that's basically it. And then every day a different track plays, and he just set what time of day those should play it. And nice. I just let him handle that. And yeah
that's really cool. When you're developing this stuff, it's all 2D,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah, but it's laid out in 3D in Unity.
Yeah, so you actually are using the parallax of 3D natural?
No.
So you coded your own parallax.
Yeah, another reason that multiple cameras don't really work, because they would be parallax for one player and the other.
And
one.
So all your backgrounds are moving,
like,
wildly crazy.
Yeah, because the
both other players are running to the right, and it's just
yep, exactly. So that, yeah. We do use the Z, the depth, naturally, because lights are actual 3D point lights. Mm-hmm. So the further something's in the background, the less light it will receive from the lights in the foreground. And that way we kind of attenuate the...
Now, do you do something like Pixel Perfect?
I've heard there's a lot of posts on Unity like, oh, Pixel Perfect this, or like, oh, it's so hard to get stuff Pixel Perfect in Unity. We render through a render texture, so it is, in that sense of the word, pixel perfect.
And it's a low-res render texture.
Yeah, it's a low-res.
And
res
then you scale that up to the viewport.
Exactly. There can be half overlapping pixels. And even then, you have to do some stuff with the parallaxing that, you know, pixel perfect has a lot of different meanings.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it means that you want every object to be at whole pixel coordinates so that they don't get choppy when you start moving the camera, stuff like that. But yeah, we do most of it. But
when do you do anything with your movement specifically to prevent strangeness? Or do you find that the render texture rendering at a lower resolution and then scaling up completely covers
that more. Solves most of the stuff. And all of your, like, all of your units in game, they don't have to be at whole pixel coordinates. They can be at half pixel mm-hmm. coordinates, as long as you just round the correct way consistently. So you have, like, linear texture point texture filtering, so no filtering on the mm-hmm. textures, and then you round everything down in the shaders, and that's like, okay, then you always get, if a sprite is standing halfway through a pixel, then he will be rendered into pixel on the left, and as soon as he was,
did you write these shaders?
I wrote all the shaders, yes. And then there's one bit of code that I copied from an old Unity shader that does some texture correction on DirectX, where you have, they call it, like, the half texel offset. Like, they start counting at 0.5 or something, and that makes everything weird. But if you correct for that, then I guess there is, like, a whole set of little things you have to do, and then it's called pixel perfect.
Yeah.
But it's not like this monolithic, like, oh, just press the pixel perfect button and everything will be pixel perfect. And all these little things are very obvious too.
I think people want, if I write something in X and A,
yeah.
for example, I can make the pixels look perfect every time easily.
Yeah.
But when I'm in Unity 3D, it's not almost designed for these low res renders. So when you want blocky pixels as part of your art, and you want it so the character is moving horizontally and those blocks aren't half rendered.
Yeah.
They're fully rendered every time, but only into the correct grid location.
I guess if you don't render to a low resolution texture, then you run into different kind of problems. But then I think you shouldn't want to round everything to whole blocks as you call them. Then you should be fine with having, you know, it's like a lot of games these days have like rotated pixels,
mm-hmm.
where like the character is holding a sword and the sword is blocky, but as soon as you start moving it's like blocky on a rotated grid, which I think looks fine too.
Yeah, it's just, I guess, the style you're going for.
Yeah.
But what if you're trying to design something like the Mega Man or the Shovel Knight type aesthetic, then you really want to nail that look,
this
low-res look.
Then you just have to render to a texture. That's just it. Like, there's no way around it. Like, that's most of it. Plus, you're saving on performance because you're rendering that much fewer pixels.
And that's a Unity Pro feature only.
Right? Not anymore. Like, that's been, like, everything that's in Unity Free and Pro has been just equalized.
Wow. Including the dark theme?
Oh, I think the dark theme...
You paid 1,500 euros for a dark theme now. Is that what you're saying?
it used to be like that for a little while. I actually use the light theme in Unity Pro, but I don't like the light theme better. Yeah, and now they're kind of, Unity's pushing all these services, right? So cloud build services, analytics, and I think that's kind of what you're paying for now is like access to all these services that they offer and the splash screen.
Okay. Yeah, so you pay and then you don't have to have the Unity splash screen.
Yeah. And now they have different tiers. Like there was a month ago, they kind of revealed their new structure.
I saw a lot of people actually choosing, I think, can you have a Unity splash screen? And this is completely irrelevant, by the way. But can you have a Unity splash screen where you design yourself to match the style of your game? And is that still okay? Or do they just force it on the build? Boom, here's the splash screen.
If you have the forced splash screen, and I don't know if that still applies right now, but when it used to be like that, it would just be their splash screen. It would always say made with Unity or Unity Personal Edition, something like that. It would just be that splash screen. And then different ones for mobile and other platforms.
Well, cool. I think we probably have a good amount for one episode. I really appreciate being here and talking to you about it.
Thanks for dropping by.
If you ever want to talk about software architecture or stuff like that, just contact me. I love chatting about it.
I will. I think if I do a next game, I'm going to do it much more like structured right from the start.
If you're interested, I have this game that I've been building. It's a board game. And the interesting thing about building a board game is that you know all the rules already.
Yeah.
It doesn't have, there's no like design as far as iterative design. So
it's an existing board game.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
Is test the crap out of it from the very beginning because I know everything that's going to happen.
Yeah.
And then I just have the presentation layer like, okay, how do I translate this idea of a cardboard thing into the digital, you know? But what I'm doing is every single thing that you do like throws events and then the events run everything. So there's nothing in the game that you can't reproduce by in your debug console just having a button that says fire these 15 events and then I'm already here in the game so I can just continue from the same point over and over again.
That's brilliant.
It's really cool. It's super storable because if I want to save the game, I save all the events. If I want to load the game, I replay all the events. If I want to have asynchronous multiplayer online, they just get up and download the new events over what they already have.
Yeah, and if you built it that way, it works. Like, I also built a sort of board game once, but that was still, like, very much, like, tied into the timing of the stuff happening. But if you've built it just, like, these events are separate from the presentation layer, as you mentioned, then you don't rely on timings. Like, for example, my game would rely on, like, oh, I'm playing a card. Like, card animation has to, like, you know, that stuff has to happen before something else can happen because only when the card would actually be on the table, it would trigger some other stuff happening.
Yeah, exactly.
But when you set it up like you do, which obviously you should, then that's not a problem.
So what I have is, and I do something in the domain objects. I say, okay, maybe draw a card or something as an example. And then an event is raised saying the player drew a card. And then the UI just animates that.
Yeah.
And it knows that when I animate this, I animate it in sequence. So if it gets other events that have other animations, the animations go in sequence.
Oh, and they just kind of queue up.
Yeah.
And as fast as
whatever you program it to, you know what I'm saying? And so there's a lot of different approaches you can do if you know kind of what you want ahead of time.
Exactly. I mean, and that's unfortunately not very often the case in games. Like you will... But
it depends, because if you're designing your own games versus working at an agency that's doing work for somebody else, like there's a lot of board game manufacturers.
Example. And then you know exactly what.
Exactly. If my job is to produce digital versions of board games, So that's what I'm thinking. There's game development, but game development even doesn't mean as much because you have small indie game developers. You have these agencies that just take a bunch of work in from whomever has good jobs for their people. Then you have these big AAA companies, you have these medium sized, and everybody has different approaches. And so there's a lot of different techniques. When I hear people say stuff like unit testing that has no place in games, I can see where they're coming from, but I disagree because there's a vast variety of different scenarios.
Right, it does work, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess as you go, you kind of learn just the rules of thumb. Like if you're starting a project, at least like the thing you mentioned before, like separate the state of an object into like a separate like object. It's like, okay, this is the state you need to persist in. Stuff like that. And I think that will make your life already a little bit easier.
Yeah.
If you have those things, then the rest you can figure out. And then in any project, you will come to a point where you realize like, oh, the structure, maybe if I had done it like this, it would have been even better.
Yeah. And you always make mistakes because you're learning.
Exactly.
And
you're making new stuff, like making different stuff. Like the next game, maybe it's a multiplayer game, and then suddenly you have that whole.
What do I do now?
Yeah.
Real time online multiplayer.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think the Unity way of doing that is just to establish a connection and update the state of these same objects
on
the different machines.
Yeah.
And that's it. You're just constantly updating the state, which is terrifying to me because I don't know what is going to happen emergent from that behavior, right?
True.
You can see how unexpected things could emerge from that situation.
Like? If you do delta updates, you mean?
Yeah, so like if the nature of my networking is I define these 18 entities that I want to sync state, and one set of operations is modifying that state over here, another set of operations is modifying the state over here, like what comes out of that?
Yeah.
And it's I don't feel like it's really super deterministic.
Yeah.
And I try to like tend towards determinism when I can, because then I can reproduce problems and stuff like this.
But then, you know, in games, it isn't that strict. Like it's like, okay, you can have the server do, you know, all the, like, you know, the authoritative server model where like the server does the computation and then sends it over to the clients, but then they have to wait for the results. So they also want to do a little bit of simulation, like, you know, predict what's going on. And then in the end, it's always like a kind of mixed system where...
Well, I hope that some of the people who are listening to this get inspired to go download some game engine and start playing, because I think that a lot of people would just have a great time making something of no consequence. I think that to me, that this is the most beautiful part. Make something without trying to make a product and just have fun.
Yeah.
And you don't know what's going to come out of it, but at least you'll have had fun.
I'm really looking forward to be able to doing that again after Kingdom is out on like at least.
And I'm really looking forward to New Worlds.
Yeah.
So when do I get that, actually?
We're kind of debating it right now, whether to sync up the launch of that with the Xbox launch or whether to release it first. Mm-hmm. Soon, in any case.
Yeah.
I mean, we're talking about like the next month or so.
All right, cool. Well, again, thanks for talking to me, man.
Yeah, thanks for coming back.